battles had. Actually, we have to backtrack a little bit. I'm sorry, we're not at Tichat yet. We're still at the end of Zion. In Yud Tet, he attacks. Pasuk Yud Tet, verse 9, he attacks the middle watch. We discussed that. They have the shofar blowing, which we discussed. Chaf Aleph is really where we got to. Yeah, Chaf Aleph, we discussed it a little bit, but it's an important idea, so with 21 we'll just go over. Vayamdu Ish Tachtav. Now we're familiar with those words. Those words actually show up in, I think I mentioned this also, with the man, which meant that nobody should go out and bring the man in on Saturday, on Shabbat. And therefore what it meant is the men were not supposed to attack into the valley, into the Jezreel Valley, because that would of course give away the game. And they would know that there were only 300. So they simply stood up at the top of the mountain and waited for everything to... There was no actual hand-to-hand combat. They waited for things to transpire down below. Pasuk 21 talks about the actual blowing of the shofar. 22 speaks about the exit to the Jordan River, which we explained only makes sense if they were surrounded by three sides, which means that 100 of the troops, of the 300 troops, had went north, snuck across the Jezreel Valley, up to the mountain of Tabor, which was a great trick. And here we have Pasuk Chachim, and that's where we were. Vayitzaik Ish Yisrael Min Naphtali Umin Asher Umin Kol Min Asher Vayirdifu Acharei Midyan. Now here's an interesting pasuk, because what it means is, first of all, we have a strange lashon, Ish Yisrael. I want you to keep that in mind, because it's going to key in rather importantly into things as they go. So there's Ish Yisrael, whoever they are, and they're brought from Naphtali Asher, which are two of the three tribes that had attacked the Midianites previously, but it failed. Umin Kol Menasheh, and also from all Menasheh, which means even from Gidon's own tribe, there was a portion of the group that simply would not go up to fight with Gidon. Vayirdifu Acharei Midyan, they chased Midyan, Malachim Shalach Gidon B'chol Har Ephraim, and then he sends messengers down to Har Ephraim. Now Har Ephraim, the border city between Menasheh and Ephraim, to give you a geographical basis, is Shechem. Shechem is the border city. It's the northern area of Ephraim, and the southern area of, it's the most southern border of Menasheh. So he sends to Shechem and below. Redu lekrat midyan v'luchdu lahem et amayim. Take the waters, take the crossings, because if you don't take the crossings, they're just going to run to the other side. Ad Beit Bara v'et ha'yardein. We don't know exactly where Beit Bara is, but the assumption is somewhere near Jericho, probably. Vayitza'ek kol ish Ephraim. So again, here, you see that phrase again? Vayitza'ek kol ish Ephraim. There's that strange lashon. All the people of Ephraim. And we're going to need to analyze exactly what this is, because it's crucial in understanding Gidon, but I just want to highlight it right now. So the people of Ephraim got together. Vayilkedu et amayim. They capture the water at Beit Bara v'et ha'yardein. They capture the Jordan. Vayilkedu shnei m'sarei midyan et orev v'et ze'ev v'yargu et orev v'tzur orev v'et ze'ev hargu b'yekev ze'ev. So it was so famous that they named places after it. Vayirdifu el midyan, they chased midyan, v'rosh orev u'ze'ev heviu el gidon me'ever liyardein. They brought his heads to the other side of the Jordan River. Now, what's not clear here is which side of the Jordan River we're talking about. That is, we're now in Pasuk Chet, we're going to come into Perek Chet, we're going to come into a conflict. That is, they captured the Jordan River and Beit Bara, wherever Beit Bara is. They're on one side of the Jordan River, and Gidon is on the other side of the Jordan River. What's not clear, however, is who's on which side. So here what you probably have to say is we're going to find out, if you take a look in Pasuk, if you skip to verse 8, Pasuk Dalet, it says, Vayavo Gidon Hayardena, Gidon came to the Jordan, Over Hu Ushlosh Mayot Ish, he crossed with his 300 people with him, Asherito, Ayefim Verotim, they're in the middle of battle. So you got to figure that Pasuk Dalet goes back in time, and that we have, you see what I'm saying, that is, if he's still with his 300 people, after all the troops get together, right, he's got all the troops together, but he's still chasing with his 300 people. Essentially what we would call today hot pursuit, that would be in verse 8, 5. Which means it seems likely, but I'm not sure, we'll see how it plays out as we read on, that he's on the other side of the Jordan River, on the east bank of the Jordan River, which is today Jordan, and that the Ephraim, who's coming and bringing him essentially in big barrels, the heads of Zev and, who's the other guy? Orev, right, that they are crossing the Jordan River to talk to him. And the question is, why? Why are they crossing the Jordan River? Why are they bringing the heads in? You might think it's to show that they did a good job, but in fact, that's not what happens. Let's go to Perek Chet, chapter 8, verse 1. Vayomu elav Ish Ephraim. You see that again? Ish Ephraim. It comes up over and over and over in this parsha, much more so than any other parsha. In fact, you'll find the word Ish is used in this parsha probably 20 or 30 times, maybe 20 times. We'll have to take a look and see why the word Ish is stressed so much and what it means, but it's a significant word. So here's Ish Ephraim, and it says, Ma davar asher ashita lanu, what'd you do to us? Levoti krot lanu, ki alachta l'ilachem Midyan, you went to battle against Midyan, v'yirivun oto ito b'chozka, and they battled against him. The assumption is the people, the Ish Ephraim, battled against Gidon with strength. Strange lesson, no? What does that mean? So I just toss out to you. I don't know if it's, you know, that deep or that complicated, but I'm wondering what it is. That is, why is Ephraim upset? I don't know if I hinted at this last week. Why is Ephraim so upset that they weren't called to battle? The assumption is, by the way, that why didn't Gidon call them to battle? Well, why do you think Gidon didn't call them to battle?
Specifically instructed not only to take the 300 guys.
That's true, but before that point, he had sent messengers to all Abiezer, which is the tribe of Manasseh.
We actually had assembled Manasseh, and then we also have Naphtali and Zvulun
and Asher to the north.
Yeah.
What we have to the south, you're right, is Manasseh to the south. In the first battle, it was Manasseh to the south. And that was the first battle that, in my opinion, and Rabbi Eliezer's opinion, is that they lost. But Ephraim was specifically not called to the battle. And the question is, why would he not be called to the battle the first time, and the second time also, even when they gathered together troops? It's true, they sent people home, but they never even invited Ephraim. Now, the question that you have to ask, of course, is, would Ephraim have come? There were a lot of people that didn't come to the battle. Other people that didn't come to the battle, by the way, was, if you remember, Naphtali, Asher, and Zvulun were in the first battle, but here it's only Naphtali and Asher. So either you could say that what happened to Zvulun, essentially. You know, there were people who obviously did not want to come, even after Gidon was doing well. There were people who didn't want to get involved in battle. So you could say they didn't invite him, because he knew they wouldn't come to the party, right? You don't send the invitation. You know, sometimes you send an invitation anyway, because you know if you send an invitation, you get brownie points. So if you know somebody's not going to come to the wedding reception, you really don't want them to come. So you know they're not going to come, so what you do is you send them an invitation, because, hey, you get the gift, right, because you sent the invitation. Plus, you're up brownie points in the old family politics game. Is that fair, or does that only happen in my family?
I think it happens.
Okay. So maybe...
But then you get surprised when they do.
Yeah, sometimes you do. That's right. So you could say that he wasn't playing those games. He didn't send a letter to them to invite them up, because he knew Ephraim wouldn't battle. And why should you battle if why should you invite somebody that's not going to come? But then the question is, but I'm wondering if there was some other motivation. That is, if he himself had a motivation where he wouldn't want Ephraim to get involved, or didn't think Ephraim should be involved. So I'm wondering if you have a thought on that.
Manasseh.
Remember what Devorah said about Ephraim.
Ephraim was involved in the battle. Mini Ephraim, excellent. You know, we're going to have to go back there, but why don't we take a look? It's in chapter 5. Is it 14? Yeah, Mini Ephraim, the pointed ones of Ephraim, Shoshamba Amalek, who have their roots in Amalek. It's not the Amalek that we know of. Acharecha Binyamin Ba'amamecha, they brought along Binyamin, which means they went as far south as Binyamin, because south of Ephraim was actually Binyamin. Mini Machir is Shevet Menashe, Yardu B'chol Krim was Milu Moshchim B'Shevet Sofer. And then when it talks about the north, it talks about Yisachar, Zvulun, Naphtali, but not Asher, actually. But there's something that, since you mentioned that, which Shevet do we believe? Well, there's two possibilities. What Shevet do we believe that she's from? Where did she actually sit? Where was her home?
It was
in Ephraim, exactly right. It's possible you could say she was from Naphtali, which is Barak's tribe, but more likely she was in fact from Ephraim. So you could explain, it makes sense that Ephraim would go together with Devorah, because Devorah was in fact an Ephraimite. The question is there a family conflict going on. That is one possibility, is that there's an inter-family conflict between Ephraim and Menasseh. The only problem is that's not reflected by Devorah. By Devorah, Ephraim and Menasseh fight together. So why wouldn't they also fight together here? Why not call Ephraim? Why wouldn't they fight? They're your brothers. They're your close brothers, closer than any other of the tribes. You're B'nai Yosef. So why wouldn't they come? And they probably drag Binyamin with them. Any thoughts on why not invite Ephraim to the party? Well, I'll send you back the question. Do you remember why Devorah was so upset at the other tribes? That is, what was ultimately Devorah, when she sings about it, what was her success and failure? Why was she so upset at the other tribes? Why was she so angry at the other tribes? Except for Yehuda, that she doesn't bother to mention. Why was she so angry at the other tribes? It's a pretty straightforward question. It's so straightforward that it seems
they didn't participate in the
battle, right? But if you remember, up until this point, not including Otniel ben Kenaz, every single battle has always been local. Ehud goes to Har Ephraim to fight against Eglon on the Jordan River. Where's everybody else? They're not invited because they do not care. Shamgar ben Anah from Shevet Shimon fights the Plishtim. Why is he fighting the Plishtim? Because he doesn't care about why only Shamgar ben Anah. Because nobody cared. Nobody wanted to help him out. The same thing with, so that's Ehud ben Gera, Shamgar ben Anat. Otniel ben Kenaz is a little different. He seems to fight Aram, which is to the north, even though he's to the south. But we said Otniel ben Kenaz is probably the king. And Devorah, we said, was actually trying to put together a coalition. Because this battle by Gidon, just like Devorah's battle, takes place in the same place, which is Emek Yisrael. Emek Yisrael is not a concern to Shevet Ephraim. It's 20, 30 miles north of Shevet Ephraim. They couldn't care less what happens in Emek Yisrael. What do they care about the northern tribes? That is, if you look at the nation of Israel as a disparate group, as a group, essentially a tribal culture, then one tribe doesn't really care about the other tribes. I don't want to take it too extreme, but if you look at the Tutsis and the Houthis, I mean, you get to the point where tribes actually kill each other, which happens sometimes, unfortunately, in Tanakh as well. But they certainly don't go out of their way to battle each other. It's not what we found. And by the way, in the rest of the book, we'll find the same thing. Battles are only fought locally. Only fought locally. The two exceptions are Devorah, who tries to put together a coalition and fails, and Gidon, apparently, doesn't even try to bother put together a coalition. He's got Asher, Naphtali, and Zvulun, which are the most northern, the tribes directly to the north of the Emek Yisrael, the Jezreel Valley. He's got Menasseh, which is essentially the only tribe to the south of it. End of story. He doesn't sing about Reuben, he doesn't sing about God, he doesn't sing about any of the tribe, Binyamin, he doesn't sing about Ephraim. He's not upset that he didn't come, because essentially Gidon, and this may reflect on his nature, may not feel that it is his job to put together a nation. Possibly. I mean, this is speculative, but why wouldn't he invite Ephraim? Why wouldn't he invite Ephraim? Because he doesn't feel Ephraim is involved. Why wouldn't he think Ephraim is involved? Only if he thinks that the battle is only a local concern, and not something that involves another tribe, or you may even say another state. I want to say, that is, you can look at the tribes almost like, what do they call cantons in Switzerland? Really significant areas where there's a distinct time, where there's a distinct, social group, and while it's one country, for sure, they're broken up into separate concerns. I may be wrong about Switzerland. I'm not that up on geopolitics, but you were right about verse 5, although I'm bouncing all over the place, as usual, of course. Or actually 8:1 probably better.
Yeah.
So I believe, although again it's speculation, that Ephraim, and by the way, it'll draw itself out later, because when all the people come to Israel and they ask him to be the king, what does he say? I won't be your king. Let God be your king. Well, that looks like a very firm statement. As we've mentioned before, it seems to be an abdication of the job. I simply don't want the job. That might be reflecting the fact that he looks at the battle against the Midianites as a local affair. Why should I call Ephraim? What's it their business? Just speculation, but I think there's something to think about. The question, what's that?
Isn't God to the north?
God is to the east on the other side of the Jordan River. You have Reuben, which is below Nachal Arnon. It's between Nachal Arnon and Nachal, it's above Nachal Arnon. Below Nachal Arnon is Moab's territory. I'm sorry, I don't have a map here. I apologize.
There's a map in the,
there's a Scott Nikra. So essentially here you have the Arnon River, which is halfway in the Jordan River, and this is Nachal Yabok. This area is Reuben. There is Reuben, or most of the area is Reuben. from more or less Nachal Yarbok up until the mountains that come to Nachal Yarmuch is Gad, and up to the north in the Bashan, and also in this little area right below the Yarmuch, is Shevet Menashe, the other half, one half of the tribe of Shevet Menashe. So Gad is right there. Okay. So he didn't call on them because he didn't think there was an issue, but there's another reason he didn't call on Gad, and we'll see why soon. The question is, why would Ephraim...
After Ephraim is called, he's the only tribe mentioned that he's called, because after their initial victory and they're in flight, he calls Malachim Shalach Gidim Chol Har Ephraim Lemor. You know, redo the threaten again. And I imagine that he played a very critical role, because at this point there's really not been a battle. The enemy is fleeing.
Yeah, you're right. My previous statement has to be wrong then. He did, in fact, after the battle was over, in which case I'd like to go back to your theory that he didn't send them because he didn't feel he was supposed to be gathering together all the troops. The other possibility is he felt that they were in the position to take the... they're running away to the Jezreel. They're running away down... That's one possibility. The other possibility is that he's not concerned about them, but it's only strategic. And the reason why it's strategic... I'll show you on a map. Again, this is a lot of speculation, so it's hard to say for sure.
And the people who took the heads were the Ephraimites. If it was Shneser and Midian, it has to be Ephraim.
That's correct. Oh yeah, they win. Oh yeah, they're the one who takes the heads.
Ephraim is really the only one that has had any conquest. Because his 300 guys didn't kill anybody.
Right, they're just chasing. Well, I mean, they killed a lot of people in the field, but they didn't capture the general.
They didn't have a major battle.
That's correct, because they only had 300 people as it was. They're running away down here. Here, they're going through the Beit Shan. This is Amik Yisrael. They're running down here into the Beit Shan area and then down into this lower area of the Jordan River to cross over. Closer to, let's see, what's down there. They're running past here at Svi. So essentially, they're in Menashe. Here's Menashe's territory, and they're in Ephraim's territory. Here's Adam Ha'ir, and here's Tzartan. You see Tzartan? Tzartan is listed in Yoshua as one of the places where the Jordan River stood up on its side. So they're running all the way down to Tzartan, which actually is directly across from Shechem. I believe Tzartan is where they ran away to. Yeah, take a look in 22. Vayikru shlosh meot shofro, vayasham Hashem at 722, et cherev ish v'yehu, v'chol ha-machaneh, v'yana shamachaneh ad beit ha-shita, srei rata. That's Tzartan. How do I know it's Tzartan? Asher al shvat nachal ev mechoma al tabat. How do I know that that's true? We would need, let me see if I'm right. Sometimes I guess at these things I'm not right. I did not bring a dot mikra. Does anybody have a dot mikra of Shochin? There used to be one here. And now I don't see it. But if I'm not...
Probably it got moved out with people in the group using it.
So you think they took it out? Possible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they get tucked away.
Well, not out, but maybe it's floating around.
And I'd love to have it, because sometimes I say the wrong thing, but if I'm not mistaken, a lot of times I say the wrong thing, but if I'm not mistaken, Srei Rata is the same as Tzartan. So again, you could say that he's sending a message to Ephraim, not because he really felt that they deserved to be part of the battle, but if you say that they ran as south as the Jordan Valley Rift, that he was telling them to take the Jordan Valley and the area because Ephraim was in a position to do so with Menashe north of that. On the other hand, it's possible to say exactly what David said, which is that he actually did feel that they deserved to be in the battle, and he sent for them as soon as he thought it was appropriate. Both are acceptable. Looking at Ephraim's side, the question is, why is Ephraim so upset? That is, if Ephraim really wanted to be in the battle against the Midianites, you have to ask a question against Ephraim, which is what? What's the question that you have to ask against Ephraim?
Why didn't they ask him?
What? Yeah, why did they wait? Let him send troops up.
Just come,
volunteer. You need somebody to call you for dinner, you know? Time for war, you make war. You don't need somebody specifically to tell you that it's an issue. If you don't come, you don't feel it's an issue to come. If you feel it's an issue to come and they won't let you fight, that's one thing. If you feel maybe you were right, you were wrong, that's another thing. But why do they feel specifically? Let's listen to their words again. Vayomru lav ish Ephraim, ma hadavar hazeh asita lanu? What did you do to us? Levilti krot lanu. How come you didn't call us? Ki alafta lechem midyan v'rivuno tam chazkan. They fought him, and they fought him quite harshly. They're essentially saying, why didn't you invite us to the party? It's a tough question. Why would they take such a position? It's a very strange position. Vayomer lehem, he says to them, Ma shiti ata kachem. What have I done What have I done that you can have done? Halo tov ololot Ephraim mibitzir every yesher. Is it not true that the little grapes, the ololot, by the way, are the grapes that are left over, they're left over after the picking. That's right. You have to leave them over. They're like leket. On the field you have a shikha, so this would be ololot. These would be the single grapes that you leave over, and you have to leave for aniyim. So it says, halo tov ololot Ephraim mibitzir every yesher. Now, b'tzir is the main crop. Now, one of the Mefarshim, what it's essentially saying, is good, but I think it goes a little bit farther. Let me read to you what it says in the Mefarshim on that pasuk, which is Chet Bet. Derech Mashal, the Radak says, Hapchutim Shebachem. He's speaking about them individually. The least ones of you, tovim me'agdolim shebanu, are better than us. It's a personal issue. Oh, another possibility Radak brings up, ololot debatzir is not a mashal on the people of Israel, but it's a mashal on Midian. Masha asa Gidon b'Midian hayakmo batzir. What Gidon did against Midian is like the Batsir, kihu hechela milchama, because the Batsir is the first portion of the crop. So he's saying my initial battle was fine, v'harag ha-machaneh shehaya rav, and the nation started killing each other, but Gidon didn't actually lift the sword. Umashi nishar achar Batsir, what was left over, hema ololot, these are the individual grapes that get left over, v'hu davar ketan keneged ha-Batsir, even though it seems like it's something small compared to the initial. Kain Ephraim lachdu sarei Midian shehema ha'alolot keneged kol ha'machaneh. They were considered the small grapes. They were the pickings. Elo shehayu sarim gdolim shezeh omar halov tov alolot Ephraim mutzir avieser. So it's actually a geopolitical statement, which I think is more to the point than the first one. He's not trying to say you guys are better than us guys, but he's saying it's much more you guys actually, as David said before, all I did was stand at the top of the thing, confuse them, and they all killed each other. So fine, so I get depressed, but you're the guys who actually took out their kings. You're the guys who took out their kings. I didn't do that. You did that. And therefore, you did the most important part of the battle. Let's continue on. In Pasuk Gimel, "Beyedchem natan Elohim et sarei Midyan, God had given it to you in their hands. Et orev et zev, umay yacholti aso kachem. What could I have done like you? I couldn't have. Az raftar ruchame Allah b'dvar hazeh." And then David goes back in time to when he's actually chasing Zevach and Shalmanah. But the first thing I'd like to, the other two kings that crossed the Jordan, the first thing I'd like to do is to do a textual comparison. You see, if there was Ephraim not coming because they should have been invited to the party because they wanted to fight against the Midianites and the story, that would be fine. But this same words appear twice in Tanakh. The next shofet to come up is none other than Yiftach, the terrible Yiftach. And let's go to Yiftach's battle, which is in Perek. You'd bet, 12-1. He's just battled against Ammon, also on the other side, by the way. Ammonites also on the other side of the Jordan River. In fact, we'll see that Yiftach himself is from Shevet. He's the Giladi, like Eliyahu HaGiladi. Gilad was the area on the other side of the Jordan River, that's the eastern bank of the Jordan River in Jordan, north, up into the Golan Heights, but not quite. And that was the place where Menasha was, but this is not the half of Menasha that Gidon's from. It's from the other half of Menasha, which is on the other side of the Jordan River. Everybody with me so far, or am I bounced around too much? So he goes to battle against Ammon, and guess who shows up in verse 12? Vayitzaik ish Ephraim. Now here they use the word Vayitzaik, which we've had before. What does Vayitzaik mean? They gather together in battle, right? Vayitzaik. Vayavor tzafona, they cross north. Vayomru liyiftach, mandua avarta livachem bnei Ammon. How dare you go to battle against the Ammonites? V'lanu lo karata lech rimach, beitcha nisrof alech of eish. We'll burn your house down. And by the way, it doesn't obviously mean their house. It means his family. Beitcha nisrof eish. Vayomru liyiftach alehem, ish riv hayita, hayiti, ani v'ani, v'nei Ammon ma'on. Look what he's doing to the people of Israel. Do you see what he's doing? I had a fight, Ani, the Ami. Well, how does he refer to his Shevet Menashe on the other side of the Jordan River? My people, which obviously is excluding who from his Am? Who's he excluding from his arm? Who's coming to speak to him though? Ephraim. You see what he's doing? He's actually saying, you're a different country. Uvnei Amon Ma'od, Ve'ezak Etchem, I called you. Now here's something very interesting. Do you see what happens? He did call them. Va'ezak Etchem, and I called you. V'lo haushatem oti mi'adam, you didn't come and help. Now we don't know that. Let's go back to 11 and see if it says anything like that. In 11, we don't really know. A battle goes on, as far as I'm doing a quick scan, and everything's happening on the other side of the Jordan River. He has communication with Amon, there's all kinds of problems, back and forth, they have to go and get him. But as far as I can tell, there's no communication whatsoever with Ephraim. Does anybody see if I'm wrong? In chapter 11. I'm pretty sure I'm right. There is no communication with Shevet Ephraim. Not as far as I could tell. And that puts a new light on the words of Ephraim. See, in the first Bigidon, we don't know whether they were invited or not, and they come over and said, how come you didn't call us to war? And then we have to try to figure out, what he didn't call for war. He sent to you as soon as, you know, he could. Gives you the impression that he didn't send them before. But Yiftach, you have the same thing. It says, Lama lo karato ala lechet. And Yiftach says, let's stop lying here. You know, let's stop telling, let's not tell lies. Va'ezak etchem, this is in 12:2. V'loho shatem otimi adam. You're my nation? Where were you when I needed you, buddy? Where were you when I needed you? Va'ereki and chamoshia. When I saw that you weren't going to save me, va'asima nafshi v'kapi, I put my life in my hands. Va'ebra el b'nei Amon, and I crossed over the Amon, va'yineim Adonai b'yadi, and God gave him, v'lame elitim elai, why did you come up against me in battle? Ayom azelehi lachem bi. Now look what happens. Va'ikpot yiftach et ko anshe gilad. He gets together all of Shevet Menasheh, the other Shevet Menasheh, the one on the other side of the Jordan River. Vayilachem et Ephraim, and a civil war breaks out. Vayaku anshe Gilad et Ephraim, and the people of Menasheh are killing their brothers. Do you see what's going on here? It's a terrible, terrible thing. They're killing Ephraim. Ki amru plitei Ephraim atem. You escapees of Ephraim. Gilad betoch Ephraim betoch Menasheh. What's going on here, by the way, is Ephraim are starting to dress up like Menasheh guys. Right? They're all from the same tribe, which means they look alike and they speak alike and they can be confused for each other. The truth is, if you met a Yehuda guy, probably wouldn't look anything like an Ephraim guy. They looked different, the language was slightly different, there were variants, there was accents, all kinds of north-south, right? Even North America, north and south, certainly that's going on in Israel as well. Different accents, different customs, different looks, different appearances. Here what it says is that Ephraim is dressing up. Look at the words, Ki amru plitei Ephraim atem. You're an escapee from Ephraim. Gilad v'toch Ephraim. V'toch Menasheh. They're Giladites, Ephraim atem Gilad, v'toch Ephraim v'toch Menasheh. They're Giladites essentially hiding among Ephraim, hiding among Menasheh. I think I'm reading that right, but I'll leave it alone until we get to it in detail in a few weeks. V'yokod Gilad etem abrote yardem Ephraim. They capture the crossings to Ephraim. V'hayaki yomru plite Ephraim evora. When anybody wanted to, they caught these. They said, it's not clear who's saying. Menasheh, I guess, is saying, plite Ephraim evora. You, the guy who's escaping from Ephraim, cross over. Vayomru lo, and they said to him, Anshe Gilad. Ephratiata, you were from Ephraim, Vayomer Lo. He said, nah, I'm not from Ephraim, I'm from Menasheh. I never heard of Ephraim. Not me, I'm a Menasheh guy. Vayomer Lo Amor Nash Shibolet. So say the word Shibolet. Vayomer Shibolet, because they couldn't say the word Shibolet. They lost the Shin. They could not speak Shin, they only spoke Shin. And they grabbed him, Vayashchatu Al Amabrot Yardem, Vayipol Beitim Ephraim, Arbaim Ushnaim Aleph. 42,000 people killed. Humongous. And he judged Israel for 6 years. So what you see is Ephraim twice comes to essentially tell to the Menasheh guy who became the Shofet, what are you doing? And the first time Gidon knew enough to relax them, to say nice things to them, to speak to their hearts so they would go home. Yiftach was not interested in them. He was more interested in killing them, actually, than trying to make peace with them, because he wasn't interested in really creating a country, a unified country. The question then asks is, if in fact Ephraim Yiftach's not lying, and Ephraim actually was sent the letter, please come and help, and they did not come and help because they did not care, and if that also happened with Gideon, which you might say it's possible, I mean, they weren't after, did they not hear there was a battle going on against the Midianites? Would they not come and help? Right? First, Gideon gathers his troops to Gilboa. Only later is he told to send them home. Did Ephraim not hear about it? Did not do anything about it? Could they not fight Midian? Apparently they weren't interested in it. Apparently they maybe got a letter, please help, and refuse. So the question is, why would they in such a case come so viciously, twice, come to war against Menashe to assert their anger? And I think the clue is in the crossing of the hands of Menashe and Ephraim. Ephraim was always the leader of the two tribes, always. Even Yoshua, they want twice the land, you remember? And then Yoshua says, what do you ask me for twice the land? Go up and cut down a bunch of trees and take more land. What are you complaining about? You got plenty of land. The first leader of Israel, really, after Moshe, was Yoshua from Shevet Ephraim. After that, it moves back south to Yehuda, but then it comes back north to Devor, to Ephraim. So here, once and twice, and by the way, later, Yeravam ben Nevat, who split the nation into two, would also be from Shevet Ephraim. Ephraim is the, you know, when we talk about Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, we're not really talking about Mashiach ben Yosef so much, we're talking about Mashiach ben Ephraim. They felt that since the nation was being unified and the victories were won, it was time to come and clean up. All right, thank you very much for cleaning up, but where was I? You know, they're very after-the-fact type of things. When they realize things were going right, then you have to be in the right political party. It's sort of like when you cross political lines when things are being successful, and then you want all the glory. And in fact, Ephraim is willing to go battle against Menashe to have that take place. Let's continue on. Going back to verse 8. Verse 8. Going back to verse 8.
Chapter
8. 5. Chapter 8, verse 5. Right. And hopefully we'll finish up all of 8. Quite big, however. What happens in 8, then, is a very interesting case, because civil war, in fact, does break out. What happens? Vayavo Gidon el Ardena, that's in verse 4, over who shlosh meyot ta'ish, asher ito ayifim v'rodfim. They're really tired. Vayomer l'anshei Sukkot, and they say to the people of Sukkot, the city of Sukkot. Now, we know where Sukkot is. Sukkot is in God's territory, on the other side of the Jordan River, below the Arnon River, above the Yabuk River. It's where Yaakov first set up shop. Remember, Yaakov, the first city he made, going back to Bereshit, was that he set up shop right before he got to Shechem. It says, let me read it to you. It's in Bereshit, probably chapter 33, 34. Where he sets up shop first in Israel, where Yaakov comes to Israel, and the first place he sets up shop before he actually enters Israel is Sukkot, and he stays in Sukkot for a year and a half. Do you remember where that is?
The year Allah.
What's that?
No, he's looking in.
In Bereshit. Yeah, Yaakov. I'm sorry, I can't find it. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But it was the first place that Yaakov came when he came to Israel. Before he got to Israel, before he crossed over the Jordan River, it mentions Sukkot, and Sukkot is also mentioned in Sefer Yoshua. It's one of the cities that was given to God. Second. Oh, here it is. Here it is. It's right after he sees the angel, Yisab says he's not going to stay in Eretz Yisrael, he's going to go south, and it says, Vayashav Vayomahu, Esav Darko Seira, Vayakov Nasa Sukkota, he went to Sukkot, Vayivim Bobayit, he built a house, Limkneo Asa Sukkot, and he also built Sukkot for his cattle, Alkein Karashayim Amakom Sukkot. So other side of the Jordan River, he has not entered Israel quite yet. So essentially, Gideon comes into two cities, and you're familiar with the story. But let me read it out in Pasuk Hey. Vayomel Anshei Sukkot, they say to the people of Sukkot, Tnu nanu kichrot lachem, give us bread, la'am asher bragli, to my soldiers, ki ayafim hem, because they're tired, vanochi, rodef acharei zevach mutzom, unam achei medyan, and I'm chasing after these two kings. Vayomel Sarei Sukkot, and people of Sukkot, the officers of Sukkot say back, akap zevach zomunah atabi adecha, what, you own zevach zomunah? Have you defeated zevach zomunah? Ki nitain latzavacha lachem, that we're going to give to your army money, bread, when God does give them to my hands, I'm going to pick up the thorns from the desert, I'm going to rip off your skin with it. Barkanim are also thorns. Then he goes to Penuel. Now these places are very distinct because Penuel was the other place where Yaakov first came. That was where he battled against the angel. Remember that? And he says, this place is Panim, Sham Ra'iti, Shem Panim Panim, Vayikrat Shem Makom Penuel. They said the same thing. I'm going to break down this thing. So far, everything seems pretty much the same. Let's skip ahead to where they actually capture. They capture Zevach HaTzalmunah. That's in verses Yud, Yud Aleph, Yud Bet, Yud Gimel. They do a little battle. Yud Dalid, they come back from the battle, and they catch Zevach HaTzalmunah, and now they come back to Sukkot. Sukkot was the first city. So we're in verse 14. Vayilko nami anshei Sukkot, vayishalu, vayish aleihu, and they ask a question, vayichtov et sarei Sukkot, et zekeneh, shivim shiva ish. 77 offers of Shechem. Vayavo anshei Sukkot, vayomer hinei Zevach HaTzalmunah, asher cheraftim oti. You cursed me, you said, I'm not going to give you food because you don't own Zevach HaTzalmunah. They took the thorns and they broke them with it, from the word to break, they took them and they smeared them all over with these barkanim, and they punished them greatly. The et migdal pnuel natat, look what happens, they come to Pnuel next. What do? They kill the people in the city. You see what happens? Now I have a question for you. What's the difference? What's the difference between the two? Pnuel, they kill the people in the city. Vayarog et anshei ha'ir. In Sukkot, we have a strange event where essentially he gets one of the boys from the city to write down the 77 names of the officers. They take out the officers and they smear them with, he does not kill them, but he gives them quite a lashing that they'll never, ever, ever, ever forget. So the question is, what's the difference between Sukkot, which gets quite a lashing, and Penuel, which gets the death penalty? Not only that, why only 77 people in Sukkot, but Penuel seems, everybody seems to die. So I ask you, what's the difference there? So here is where you have to look at the text. If there's a different punishment, there must have been a different crime. So therefore, yeah, what you need to do when you analyze the text is take a look at the different crimes. So let's take a look and see if we can notice something interesting about the crime. Sukkot. There you go. That's exactly right. Pasuk Vav. By the way, in Pasuk Hey, who did Gidon speak to in Pasuk Hey? He speaks to the people of Sukkot, the broad people. It's a democratic issue. People of Sukkot, listen to me. Back me up in my battle because I have to go to battle against Zevach HaTzalmunah, and I'm going to fight them. Now, here's another important thing to remember for Sukkot and Penuel side. These Midianites and Bnei Kedem are all from the other side of the Jordan River. They own the other side of the Jordan River. How do we know that? If we go back to the very beginning of verse of chapter 6, if I'm not mistaken, it says, no, it doesn't specify that the tribes on the other side of the Jordan River were captured, but reason to assume that if they've already crossed over to Amic Jezreel from that area, from the essentially what's today Transjordan in Saudi Arabia, that the tribes on the other side were suppressed by Midian, Amalek, and by Bnei Kedem. So there's reason to understand why they would back up, because essentially their rulers were not Gidon at all. Their rulers were, in fact, Zebach and Talmunah. That was who owned them, just like Nebuchadnezzar owned Yerushalayim. If they've already crossed over the Jordan River and they're attacking inside of Israel, inside Manasseh, and they're coming from the other side of the Jordan River and they're running back to the Jordan River, you have to assume that they own that area politically. There's no battle going on there. We don't see any battle going on, which means the de facto ruler of these places is none other than Zebach and Talmunah. So of course they don't open up the gates and give them the food, because their boss is Zebach and Talmunah. And by the way, you see what happens in Sefer Melachim, we'll get to it, when they try to go against, when the nations are conquered by, for instance, Shalmaneser V conquers Shomron. He doesn't completely conquer Shomron. He kills a guy named Pekach. He makes the last northern king named Hoshea the king. And the northern king Hoshea is fine. For 10 years, there's no problem, because he's serving Shalmaneser, the Assyrian king, and all is nice and dandy as long as he keeps sending the money. But when Hoshea decides to go against Shalmaneser, then Shalmaneser comes and he destroys them. Here too, the people in Sukkot were controlled by Zebach and Talmunah. Why would you go against your controllers? Because if you do, then they'll come and wipe you out. They'll come and kill you. If you don't, you know, why would you assume that Gidon's going to be successful across the other side of the Jordan River? But what's interesting here is he doesn't turn to the Sarim. Not only that, he doesn't even know the names of the Sarim. Interesting, right? He catches a nar from the city on the way back. He says, write me down the 77 names. He doesn't even bother finding out who they are. It's not like he shows up to see and says, let me talk to who's in charge here. Never does it. In Pasuk Hey, what he says is, Vayomer l'anshei Sukkot, people of Sukkot, Tznuna ki krot lachem, give me food. And by the way, take a look at the tense he's talking. Tznuna ki krot lachem. Is Tznu plural or singular? Tznu is plural. But look who answers him. Vayomer sarei Sukkot. Now, sarei is plural, but what is Vayomer? Singular. Why is it singular? So the Mefarshim, to simplify, the Mefarshim say they picked one guy to speak from him. But that's not Masma the Psukim. What's Masma the Psukim is something else very interesting, which should make sense. Sarei, while it's true it's many people, are politically considered what?
One
ruling body. I'll give you an example, not in English. The government says, I don't say the government say, Congress says, I don't say Congress say. Do you say Congress say? Or do you say Congress says?
You're right. The group says.
Yeah. It says you treat them as a single
body.
Yeah. There's the group of 77 people. Gido doesn't want to talk to them. Gido doesn't say tamely. Let's go to Sarai. He doesn't even know their names. He walks in. He says, Chevra of Sukkot, I've come to save you. And what you're going to do for me now is you're going to give me this bread. Who speaks back to him?
Yeah.
The Sarim. So you say, wait a second, who are you talking to here? You're forgetting, excuse me, Mr. Gidon, no, we're in charge. And not only that, we don't answer to you, we answer to Zevach and Talmud. Now we're not giving you bread. Hakaf Zevach, now what? Have you conquered them? Does it mean, are they no longer our overlords? That we're going to take a chance and not support you in your battle? Hmm? That's what they're saying to him. And therefore, when he comes back to Sukkot, who does he wipe out? He wipes out just the Sarim. He doesn't touch the people. He doesn't break the city. You see, for Penuel, he didn't even promise it. Here's something very interesting. Take a look at what he promises the people of Penuel in Pasuk Tet. Vayomer God l'anshei Penuel emor b'shuv Yerushalayim etoch et ha-migdal hazeh. I'm going to break down. Now, we didn't even know what Migdal it is, by the way. We have no idea what Migdal it is. The only way we know what Migdal it is if we compare it to Avimelech. Remember Avimelech got pummeled in his head from a Migdal? Do you remember that? A woman, they were in a Migdal. I'll do it next week because it's a little too much. It was not a big. It was a grindstone, a gigantic grindstone. So let's not get into the Migdal issue, but it's going to be very important because there's going to be a match to Shechem. There's going to be a match to what goes on in Shechem and Avimelech. But all it says is I'm going to break down the city walls. But if we actually take a look and see, let's go and see who talks to him from Penuel and Pasuk Chet.
Right, what are we, Pasuk
Chet? We're in a Chet. 8-8.
Oh.
Yeah, we're definitely sticking in 8. I'm sorry.
I
apologize. No, we're definitely in 8-8. Vayalmi sham Penuel. So then he goes to Penuel. He says, let me get some food from Penuel. Vayidaber elayim kazot. He says the same thing, which means, please give me some food. Vayanu oto achei Penuel. Who speaks to him?
The
people. Do you see? The people speak back. Vayanu. It doesn't say vayomer sarei. Vayanu. All the people got together and he said, we don't care about you, Gidon. Go away. Nothing. You are nothing to us. Kasher anu anshei Sukkot. Who rules us, the people? Who rules us? Zevach and Salmunah. Not So there's no level of separation, and therefore when he comes back to Sukkot, he could just destroy the leadership, because once he destroys the leadership, who's going to come out? The silent majority, the street, the famous street. But there is no street in Penuel. The street is firmly with Midian. There is one thing which I want to mention, and we'll probably close up. We'll do a few more psukim, and then we'll close up there. I am not sure, but I believe geographically this doesn't make sense. See, we looked at Karkar, and we said Karkar was direct east, about a good 100 miles, 50 miles, straight east, which means if he's coming over the Jordan River from Tzrerata, here, okay, in this area, he's going directly into God's territory, and then he's going to chase them out to Karkar, directly east. In order to get to Sukkot, we know where Penuel. What was Penuel? He brought all of his people south below the Yabok River, right? And then what did he do afterwards? Then he went back to the other side of the Yabok River by himself. Do you remember that, Yaakov?
Mm-hmm.
And then that he went by himself on the other side of the Yabok River to pray. It's not clear, to gather the kalim that he forgot. Not clear why he's going back. He's going back essentially into God's territory is essentially here. You know what? Instead of me guessing, let me get the actual. Oh yeah, here it is. Here's the Gilad. The Gilad essentially extends down to Nachal Yabok, which means I was wrong. From the Yabok to the Yarmuch, this is all the Gilad, Chavot Ya'ir, Ben Menasheh, all of this territory is Menasheh. This territory from Yabok, about halfway down, is Gad, and halfway down, let's say from the top of the Jordan River down to the Achal Arnon is Reuven, south of that is Moab's territory. So essentially Reuven and Gad shared this territory. This area, and a little bit north of it, was owned by Menasheh. He's chasing them out through God. In fact, this may even have the name of the place. Let's see if it has Sukkot on it. I don't see Sukkot, but it's somewhere around here. He chased them directly out to Sukkot. He's heading east to go to battle. He is now going to Penuel, but Penuel, we know, is on the northern side of the Yarmuk River, which matches the word, by the way. Take a look in Pasuk Chet. It says, Vayal Misham Penuel. You see what he does? He has to go up into the mountains and go geographically north to get to Penuel. Why, I ask you, and remember, which side of Penuel is on? Which side of Penuel is? It's on the northern side of the Jordan River. Of the Yarmuk River, putting it into the Gilad area. Again, who owned the Gilad? Which Shevet owned the Gilad? Menasheh, the half tribe of Menasheh. What Shevet is Gidon from? Menasheh. So he goes to God, and God's officers are not listening to him. The people may, but the officers are not listening to him. He's desperate for food. He's got to chase them 100 miles directly into the area. He needs food desperately. He has to make a side trip, and where does he go? It makes common sense. He can't go anywhere else to God if the main city's not listening to them, Sukkot, if the main city and God. And by the way, Reuven, he's not going to try. You know why he's not going to try Reuven? Reuven wouldn't come to Devorah. They're not going to come to him. Then he's not going to try Reuven. Where does he go? He goes to his brothers. Let me go to my brother. Let's go to Penuel, which is in Menasheh's territory. Whether it was Menasheh's or God's is hard to say, but it was certainly closer to Menasheh. It certainly had influences of Menasheh. And his own people say, no. That's totally unacceptable. Because essentially if he lets them be, it means how could he even be a leader of his own people, Menasheh, if the other side of Menasheh won't even come together? So when he comes back, what he does is he kills them all. He wipes out the city, because that city essentially is a statement that we don't hold by Menasheites don't hold by our own tribal leader as our tribal leader. And therefore they deserve death for two reasons. One is because the people themselves refuse to accept Menasheh, but I think it's more poignant that the people who refuse to accept Menasheh, the ruler of Menasheh, was Menasheh themselves. And therefore they get such a strict punishment, as opposed to Penuel, which had two things going for them. One is the people never said what they were going to do, and maybe they would have gone with it had they had it. And second, well, they were from a different Shevet, so, you know, you could say, all right, you know, they weren't so hot on me because they were from a different Shevet altogether. What's that?
You mean the people of Sukkot?
Sukkot, yeah, because Sukkot, okay, I could see where Sukkot, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. But the officers that refuse to accept me, that I can't have, because I'm building a country here. And I'm building a country, you can't have officers that just don't listen to you. Verses 17, just to move through it quickly. Verses 17, I think. No, verse 17 is where they break down and they kill all the people in the city. Most of the people in the city. We did this before. This is where he asked, where are my brothers? And this is how we prove that, in fact, they had already gone bad in battle. he captioned their brothers. This is where they said they look just like you. And he says, yes, in fact, they were my brothers. And he says, had you not killed them, I would never have killed you, but now I'm going to get my Nar to kill you. The Nar refuses to kill him. They demand ki'ish kigvurato. Let a man be... it's a very strange lashon, by the way. Vayomer zevach utzamana. Look in verse 21. Vayomer zevach utzamana kumata ufgabanu. Get up, and you hit us. Why? Ki cha'ish gvurato. Now let's try to translate that exactly. Because ki, since, or when, cha'ish, like a man, gvurato, is his strength. What does that mean? It's a very... It's an idiom that must mean something. What do you believe that idiom means? How does that sound? What are they saying to him? What are they saying to him? Any takers on what that means? David, do you have anything on that?
No.
What does that mean? Begabah, you strike us. Ki cha'ish gvurato. Because, like a man, is his strength. It should remind you of something, which we've discussed before in class. When else do we have an incident that a king demands to be killed by the leader, as opposed to some other guy?
Shaul.
So let's take a look at Shaul, but Shmuel. Shmuel. Let's take a look at Shmuel. That would be in Perek Tedvav, I think, of Shmuel Aleph. Is it Tedvav? Yeah, it's Tedvav. What's that?
What does
it say?
Saying that he wanted them to, if you're going to kill me, just kill me in one strike. If you have a small person, it might be painful.
It's a strange thing to ask for, but okay. It's clear that they're struggling with kika'is gvurato, like a man is his strength. I would have said it reminds me more of this case, and let's see what he says. Vayomer Shmuel Agisha Alai Et Agag Melech Amalek Vayelech Elav Agag Mavido Vayomer Agag Achein Sar Mara Mavik. You are truly the man of death. So that doesn't really fit. That doesn't. There's no real connection there. So what exactly are you trying to say to him? So let's take a look at the Mefarshim. When you have a strange lashon like that, you should look at the Mefarshim. And the Mefarshim Radak says like this: Ki Ka'ish Kvarato. I think the Radak gives the standard papers of the of I think what most people might think. Lo namut al yidei nar. Let us not die by the hands of a youngster, right? Because the youngster wouldn't do it because he asked the youngster to do it. Shinitzta'er b'pgiato, just like the mitzvah, just like your mitzvah said, follows the radak. Not because it's a shame for us, but because he won't do a good job. Ki gibor, ki ein lo gvur, he doesn't have strength. Vad adayim v'koach sheakev banu b'pavachat meira. Atah shatah gibor ki kamol ki ish gadol kein gvurato. Because you're a big guy, therefore I know you'll kill us. But tegav banu avanu yerech meira. We'll die very fast. The only problem with that, of course, is the word Nar does not just mean a young boy. Nar, of course, means a warrior, because David was called a Nar, and other people were called a Nar. You're only a Nar. Nar is not necessarily a sign of youngness.
Yonatan and his Nar attack alone.
Correct. I'll give you another example. Yoshua was called a Nar. The Yoshua Nar, Misharet Lefnei Moshe. Who is Yoshua? Before he shows up as a Nar who's serving Moshe, he's the head of the guy who's battling Amalek. He's a general. So the word Nar does not necessarily mean somebody who's young, but it's certainly possible that's what it means here.
Well, it seems to, because he talks here about his Bechor, he talks about his son and then Nar, so it puts the two of them together, so it sounds like a young
boy. So he could be a young boy. But my question is, if the guy's already not killing him, then what are they talking about? That is, let's take a look at what happens. In Pasuk Chaf, it says, "Vayomer liYeter b'cholo." He says to Yeter, his firstborn. And by the way, I assume his firstborn is battle. And by the way, that means the firstborn is one of the 300 that's gone with him into battle, right? He only has 300 people. That's all he has. It's not like he has, it's not a host where he's got little boys hanging around that could afford to serve. He's one. Yeter is one of the 300.
Maybe. We don't know where he is now. He could have returned home.
Yeah, you know what? Mustamina, he might have, because he already has come back to Penuel and he's already come back to Sukkot. Yeah, in Hachinami, you're right. True. Haragotam, v'lo shalaf anar chabo, he wouldn't pull his sword, ki arei ki odeno nar. He was scared because he was still a nar. Whether that means a young boy or whether it means untested, I don't know. There you have to take a look at David HaMelech, because when Shaul tells him to go and put on all of the armor, remember that?
Yeah.
Remember when he goes, ki anar, You know, he says, you can't go out to do battle against Goliath, ki narata, because he's a young boy. So we get the sense that he's a young boy, but he's not, because immediately afterwards, he goes and starts, he's fighting as a general of the army. How old was David when he took out Goliath is a topic of much discussion, but the word nar does not necessarily, and by the way, in Phoenician, nar is changed to marilus, or Marianus, and Marianus is a chosen one.
Implies something negative, derogatory, though.
Nar?
Yeah, because even
now
we have
by Yosef.
Yiddish.
But that's even then, it's meant to mean he's a lot less than Moshe.
Well, actually, I have another case. Remember where Yoav's got his 12 people fighting the other people with the swords, and they're holding the heads and the swords, and they're 12 Narim fighting other 12 Narim. So we have an ancient tablet from Jordan with an image of 12 of people fighting that way, hand on the head, hand on a sword with the sword into the side, and whoever gets to stick in wins first. It's a tablet that was found by Yadin, and they all have beards. So the word Nar and Yigal Yadin explains that Nar means the chosen one. It means the chosen one. That's the best modern. He's the best of the best, actually. But you're right, it certainly has multiple meanings at different times. But let's go back to this issue. Any way that you look at it, no matter how you translate Nar, the Nar wouldn't do it. Right? So if they say ki ish gvurato, what's that? Okay,
he's a nar. So the nar clearly means to depict something less than quite well developed here.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it's talking about age.
No, I'm not saying
he's
just saying something
capable.
You know,
maybe
he
felt.
Well, he had a sword. Velosh anaf anar harbo. Oh, he had a sword.
Yeah.
There's no question he had a sword.
Yeah, but he had to wield.
But he was afraid, and
maybe
he was afraid. Why? Because he was yet a nar. So the nar is not a complimentary term here.
Or certainly speaks of all.
Untried.
Yeah, the word yarei also speaks. The word yarei fear sort of goes back to Gidon. To go down to battle, if you're afraid at night to break the, if he was afraid to break the Mizbeach during the day. I'm going to take a look at this and see what I could find. I think it's significant because, again, you would expect that Yeter would inherit the kingship from him, and all Yeter does is die by the hands of Avimelech. So that may be important. I didn't think about that. But either way you look at it, no matter how we translate Nar, the Nar wasn't going to do it. The Nar refused. So afterwards it says, if you can say ki ki ish kavurato means because you're stronger and you'll do a better job of killing us, but who's left? What does that mean? If they were afraid of that, they should have said it before he didn't draw his sword, right? As soon as you said to Yetzer b'choro, I want you to kill them, then Zevach and Shalmanah should have popped up right away and said, no kids, our heads will be halfway off, like what's his name in Harry Potter, where the head's only, what's it called, a half-headless Peter, or something, where his head's only halfway off. If that was true, then why didn't they say it before? Why did they say afterwards? I don't know exactly what the answer is. I'm curious to see other Mefarshim. But I can read you a very interesting Gemara. I'm getting late. We're already 5 minutes afterwards. And I want to read you something interesting, the way Chazal have interpreted this passage. It's worth saying, and again, dear Josh, I've often said I'm always uncomfortable with 7th graders in my 8th grade class. I'm certainly uncomfortable with 7th graders in my adult class. But so if it's too much for you, I apologize for you and your father ahead of time. But the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which I hope I could find without wasting too much more of your time. There's Bava Metzia 1, I need Bava Metzia 2. There's never a Gemara around me. Bava Bava Batra, Bava Jerry. Hey, Dalad Amin Aleph. Strange story, which I'll read to you, and I think we'll end, and then I'll just finish up one more pasuk, and then we'll end, so we're not quite through with Chet, but at least we made some progress. Hey, Dalad Amin Aleph. Ki havu miklai Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, Bahadi Adadi. When Rabbi Shmuel, the famous Rabbi Shmuel, of Rabbi Shmuel Amar B'Shoshay, Midrot HaTorah, Nidrash of him, he was the son of Rabbi Yosef. And Rav Elazar bar Rav Shimon, that's Rav Shimon bar Yochai. So Rav Elazar was one of the guy who hung out in the cave and ate it with his father. When they used to meet each other, Havu Ayol Bikra Detura Beneyu, you could pass, when they used to meet each other face to face, you could pass the yoke of an ox underneath their stomachs, Velohaya Nagabahu, and it wouldn't touch them. They were so fat, they were so humongously fat, the two of them, that stomach to stomach, you could pass a yoke of an ox underneath, in between their legs. Amar lahu hahi mitranita. So this matron, who was a Roman woman, married to some kind of senator or some important woman, says, "Bneicham einam shochem, your children can't be yours." So essentially, wants to testify that the children could not possibly be theirs, and they're all—it's all a big fake—and and also indicating that their wives slept around. Amruva shalahen gadol mishalanu. Our wives' stomachs are bigger than ours. That's what they said. Our wives' stomachs are bigger than ours. And obviously, if they could have kids and their stomachs are big, then obviously a big stomach, even though we're immensely fat. And by the way, we'll find out that they are, like, just to guess from the measurements that are listed here, probably about 400 or 500 pounds, at least. They're really humongous. Really, really large. What's that? Yeah, a real sign of wealth. Exactly right. A real sign of beauty and wealth, actually, back then. Yeah, even beauty. Rabbi Yochanan, I can talk about Rabbi Yochanan, was another fat guy, actually, who was considered one of the most beautiful people around, and he was fatter. He was almost as fat as the two of them. Yeah, back in the old day when it used to be okay to be fat. So then they say, listen, their stomachs are bigger than ours, and they could anatomically have children, so how come we can't anatomically have children? So then the woman answers. The woman says, "Kolshekain, okay, that's fine. But if you add you together, Kolshekain means if you add you together, plus them together, there's no way you're having kids. Okay, I'll buy you being fat, you could have kids, and them being fat, you could have kids, but no way together you have kids." Iki de Amrei, there are those who say, "Hachi Amruva." This is what they say to her: "Ki kaish gvurato, like a man is his strength." Now again, they're trying to prove what? They're trying to prove that they're able to have kids, even though they're immensely fat. Josh, I really apologize. Mr. Foss, I'm really sorry about this. They're trying to say that anatomically we could have kids. Do you understand? I don't think I'll describe it anymore. Ki ka'is kiburato. Like a man, that's his strength. Ka'is is obviously a euphemism for something else. So, I don't know whether Chazal are trying to interpret this pasuk homiletically, and they're just trying to say, you know, I'm going to use it here as a good point to go with the story. But or that is whether Rabbi, keep in mind, this is Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Lazar, you know, masters of Torah. Rabbi Shmuel is the one who defined how we learn Torah, and he darshens out this pasuk to indicate that a man has a power which goes beyond his stomach anatomically. If that's the way we interpret it back here, actually it becomes more interesting, the words that they say to him. Vayomer zevach v'tzalmudah kum utav gabano ki ka'ish gvurato. I'm not sure it's such a complimentary statement that they're making to them. I don't know if that's how you would interpret it. That is, I know how Chazal interpreted it in Bava Metzia. I don't know whether they're interpreting it homiletically, like it's a pulpit speech, and they're misusing a pasuk to make a point, or whether they're saying that that's what Zevach and Talmud meant. You're all in your sword, so to speak, you know. You got that sword thing going.
I mean, now it's starting to sound like a macho male thing.
Well,
right.
It may
sound like a macho male thing, and actually they're not afraid to die. They don't indicate here anything like that. Kuma tafa gabon.
They
want to
die quickly and cleanly.
Yeah, and either that or they want to die like men.
Or they want to insult them going down. And by the way, if you want to say they insult them going down, that sounds like the parallel story with Agag and Shmuel. Achein sar mara mavet. Oh, I see, the angel of death has come. So there's an essence in that. Yeah, they can't afford to be afraid. They're in the middle of nasty. This is really a side point. I don't think it's a major, you know, I don't think it would help us understand Gidon better or not better. I'm just curious about the way that... What's that?
David and Melech kills the guy who would dare to kill the king, right?
Right.
So there is something to be said about the power that the person has who is going to do the deed here. So,
yes.
And it should be somebody great. It wouldn't be somebody... So there's parallel that way, is to say, once again, it's a macho thing. They're saying, we want to die like men, we want to die
by the hands of the king. I agree with you completely, and that's the way I would have interpreted it, except for the fact that it doesn't fit the words ki ka'is gvurato. It just doesn't fit it language-wise. And because Radak ignores, and then Radak comes up with the same thing that shows up in Yomitsuda, coming up with the idea that it'll hurt less, because they struggle with, I think what everybody's expecting is, we should die by the hands of a great man, and unfortunately the words just don't match. I thought it might be interesting just to show you a usage of the phrase, and again, here I'd be careful. It could be that they're using it like a pulpit rabbi uses pasuk. You know, that I was friends with Shmuel Horowitz, who was the rabbi over the other shul. He said, it doesn't make a difference what parsha it is and what celebration I'm at. I could always find something in the parsha and mass celebration. Why? Because the Torah is a very malleable thing, and everybody knows you're speaking homiletically and not exegetically. You're not trying to prove a point. You're trying to, you know, use the Torah as a nice garnish, and you're going to reinterpret. It's not clear to me whether Rabbi Shmuel is reinterpreting it so that they have something nasty to say back to the Matronita, Well, whether they're actually interpreting the pasuk, if they do, it shows an interesting light about the personalities of Zebuch HaTamana, who we know very little about. In any event, he takes their benefits.
I'm still saying I'm not looking at this as some kind of besmirching the other guy. This is a statement about my own pride. That's what they're saying. So we're really men, which is what these two guys could have been saying to this woman. They weren't necessarily saying to her, "You're being a jerk." They may have been saying to her, "See."
So Zebuch and Talmud are referring to each other, themselves,
yes,
then, and not
themselves.
Them. Maybe Kiki Ishkvuato, very, very much so. Yes, could be. Now, I'll end off with one idea, and I know we're going a little late, but I want to show you something. That word that I point out over and over again. Look at Pasuk 22 of verse 8. Vayomru Ish Yisrael El Gidon. Do you recognize this?
Yeah.
Once again, Ish Yisrael. Ish Yisrael, Ish Ephraim, Ish this, Ish that. The word shows up, if you just make a count, a humongous amount of times. Vayomru Ish Yisrael, Mishal Banu Gamata Gamincha Gambenbenecha, rule over us. And Gidon says, no, I won't do it. Now we'll get into that next week. Oh, actually, next week maybe we'll do Purim because it's actually on Purim that we're meeting, or on Shushan Purim that we're meeting. So maybe we'll do Purim, but if you want, we'll continue with this and we'll discuss what was it that Gideon wanted out of kingship and not. But I want to point out something very interesting, which is food for thought. Ish Yisrael, which has only been recognized in battle before, right? Vayavo Ish Ephraim Vayelachem Ato Vayavo Ish Ephraim Ela Nochama. Ish Ephraim seems to indicate something of battle, people of power and recognition. They come to him and say, we want you to be the king. Everything looks very nice. And he says, no, I won't do it. I want to point out something very interesting. Let's go to the end of life of Avimelech. If you would have said, who supported evil Avimelech? Avimelech was the son of Gideon, who killed the 70 other brothers, and he ruled in Shechem, which means he was really being supported by, who would you say, not so much Jews, but like the weird kind of non-Jews that lived in Shechem, right? He didn't seem to have supported the Jews at all. He was a local leader. He didn't have much say. He only ruled for 2 years. He was a minor bum. Nobody listened to him, right? Nonetheless, take a look at the very end of the Battle of Avimelech. I'll leave you with this, where he gets his head caved in. Please take a look at chapter 10, I think. No. Chapter 9. Chapter 9. Nun Gimel. And by the way, there are a lot of parallels that we're going to have to start drawing between Avimelech and his father, and we'll do that next week. Vatashlech Isha, or maybe the week after, Vatashlech Isha Achat Pelech Rechev. Pelech Rechev is a grindstone. Al Rosh Avimelech. On his head. Vatarach et Gul Gadol. It cracked in his head. Vayikra Meheirao Anar. And he calls quickly to the Nar. Obviously it's cracked, but he's not totally dead. Nosei Kelav, who was carrying his weapons, Vayomer lo shlofchar v'chal motateini. Quick, pull your sword and kill me. Penyom ruli ishar agtanu, lest they say about me, a woman killed me. Very interesting. Compare, he's really being compared, I'm not sure he's being compared to like, it's like a mix of Gidon plus Zevach and Talmunah. It's a strange mix. Vayikareyu naro vayamot. Now his nar has no problems, right? Gidon's nar has some respect for what he is.